Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway, coming at you from a mobile setup. If it sounds a bit different, it's because I'm recording this via my phone. We are talking about part 8, chapter 13, Levin's faith is restored. Swim said the mama fish, he said, so I found this review of Anna Karenina, quote unquote review, that I find hilarious. I have loved satire from the time I read Jonathan Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal, way back when. The review is purportedly written by Todd Gitlin, corresponding secretary, Committee for Literary Purification. It's really Todd Gitlin, chairman of the PhD program in the communications at Columbia University, and the author of The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. To whet your appetite, dear Mr. Tolstoy, it has come to our attention that you have offered for sale a book that purports to describe the world from the point of view of a woman. Even as actual women everywhere are in practice erased, you try to disguise your appropriation by taking this woman's name as the title of your book, but women everywhere see through your ruse. Real life, Anna Karenina's, understand that you are projecting your ignorant, arrogant, fellow-centric fantasies onto a female character whose humanity you have stripped away. Damn. What an idiot. That's so dumb. To say that an author writing from a woman's point of view is appropriating, femininity? So men can only write men? It's dumb. That's so dumb. I mean, I'm not saying he got it all right. He might have got it wrong, but it's not appropriation. It's literature. Arrogant, fellow-centric fantasies of a female character whose humanity you've stripped away. This is the other thing I hate about these people that say, it's impossible to write a female character because if you have anything unfair happen to them or if they display any weakness, which humans do, and that's what's good about literature, then it's like, well, why did she act weakly? It's like, well, all of the characters acted weakly. I don't know, you can't win. Everyone just wants a strong female kick-ass character. Even if all the other characters in the book are human in their weaknesses. I didn't read the rest of the article, by the way. I'm not going to. JMama8779 said, I would like to clarify that the article did raise some good points. I wasn't making fun of it. Oh, I think I skipped it. Oh, JMama8779 said, this article is woke AF. In all seriousness, though, I'd like to hear from those of us that actually enjoyed this book. I loved War and Peace so much that I'm reading it again now, but this was just painful to get through. You know, I didn't mind this, Anna Karenina. It's one of the ones I've preferred more from the Hemingway list. I didn't engage with it much. War and Peace I loved. I really liked War and Peace. But I didn't hate Anna Karenina. It was very readable. Didn't drone on and on too much, even though it was a really long book. The author wrote it with bearing in mind the reader, I felt like. And put some effort into actually tidying up his prose and making it palatable, as opposed to Dostoevsky, where it's just a look at me party, someone call me a genius, and he's at the expense of the reader's entertainment. It's just masturbatory, really. At least with Brothers Karamazov, that's what I thought. So I liked it. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It had its moments where, you know, it's a bit frustrating to be 600 pages into a book and not be connected to any of the characters. It wasn't the best book I've ever read, but, you know, I got through it. We got through it. TA131901 said, I love Tolstoy's psychological insights and I think his female characters are very believable, but in the works I read, at some point, he just can't help getting on his soapbox and telling the reader about the right way to live. In Anna Karenina, he held off for, 700 pages? That's pretty admirable. I think he writes good female characters too. War and Peace is a good example of that. There's so many different balanced characters in that book. Let's keep moving. I'm thinking about the difference of how they juxtaposed Anna's approach to motherhood with, is it Kitty's, the one who breastfed at her own detriment? You know, it's not like they're all portrayed in the same way, all the women in the book. Simply Productive said, it just feels like Tolstoy is trying too hard. Does he make money the more he submits this drivel? I believe in a higher power, but I don't exactly adore organized religion. So again, I'm like Levin in that respect, but I would never take it upon myself to rant at poor, unsuspecting person about every woke thought I have about God. It's just not my place. I find this book tiresome. What rating did I give it forever ago? I'm settled on 3 stars at the moment out of 5. It's just okay. There are some great chapters, a lot of medium chapters, and too many awful chapters. It isn't a total waste of time, and there were some little surprises. I was pleasantly surprised at the number of subplots, but the characters are the best aspect. They're fully fledged and vivid characters. Unfortunately, that means I actively dislike some of them because they would be shit humans. Most people on this sub actively dislike Levin because he's basically arrogant and self-righteous, and quite a number of us also disliked Anna because she was selfish, dramatic, unreasonable, and a truly terrible mother. If Tolstoy's biggest achievement is writing vivid characters, why did he write ones that we don't like at all? Meanwhile, over at the War and Peace sub, there are plenty of very likeable characters, and even the disagreeable ones are fairly funny. It seems like Anna Karenina is a book for high school girls, if that makes sense. Girls who crave some danger and have a bit of a brain and need to basically learn from someone else's mistakes. Hey, oh, 19th century woman, don't marry a man, have a child, cheat on him, have another child, and become an addict, and off yourself. Awfully good advice there, Tolstoy. I don't think it's advice. I think it might be a cautionary tale, not advice. Anyway, I'm glad that he revised the book to make society responsible for some of what happened to Anna, because that is true to real life, but I'm also in the boat where I firmly believe that this was a self-imposed hell of a life for the most part. I don't like the boomer attitude of pulling up your bootstraps in all cases, but in this one it's certainly apt. Anna, you should have pulled yourself up by your bootstraps, stayed with your husband, learned to communicate, toughed out the rough years as much as possible, maybe with some maturity. None of this would have happened, but as it stood, Anna had the emotional maturity of a plasterboard. Good God, this week cannot go by quickly enough. I Am Norwegian said, I've loved the line about how Levin had been living well, but thinking badly. But if this is how Levin finds faith, I have to admit that I will be a little disappointing. It will be a little disappointing. It's too quick and easy. I might be only be saying that because I read a confession and there the process was long and arduous. People do have religious revelations all of the time. Yeah, it wasn't very sudden religious awakening. And doesn't really make sense with the rest of the book, does it? Let's keep reading. Chapter 14 goes forever. God damn it. All right, let's read it. Levin looked straight before him and saw the herd of cattle and then his trap and his horse, Raven and the coachman, who, having driven up to the cattle, was speaking to the herdsman. After that, close by, he heard the sound of wheels and the snorting of a well-fed horse, but he was so engrossed in his thoughts that he did not wonder why the coachman was coming for him. That occurred to him only when the coachman drove up and called to him. The mistress has sent me. Your brother and another gentleman have come. Levin got into the trap and took the reins. As if just awakened from a dream, it was long before he could collect his thoughts. He looked at the well-fed horse, lathered between the legs and on his neck where the reins chafed it. Looked at Ivan, the coachman, sitting beside him, and remembered that he had been expecting his brother, that his wife was probably disturbed at his long absence, and he tried to guess who the visitor that had come with his brother might be. His brother, his wife, and the unknown visitor appeared in a different light to him now. It seemed to him that his relations with everyone would now be changed. There will be no disputes. With Kitty, never any quarrels again. With the visitor, whoever he may be, I shall be amiable and kind, and with the servants, with Ivan, everything will be different. Tightly holding in the good horse, who snorted impatiently and pulled at the reins, Levin kept turning to glance at Ivan, who sat beside him, not knowing what to do with his unoccupied hands, and continually pushing down his shirt as the wind blew it out. Levin tried to think of some pretext for beginning a conversation with him. He wanted to say that it was a pity Ivan had pulled the saddle girth so tight, but that would have sounded like a reproof, and Levin desired an amicable conversation. But he could think of nothing else to say. "Bear to the right, sir, there's a stump there," said the coachman, taking hold of the rein. "Please leave it alone and don't teach me," said Levin, annoyed at the coachman's interference. Just as it always did, interference vexed him, and he immediately felt how wrong had been his conclusion that his spiritual condition could at once alter his manner when confronted with reality. When they were still a quarter of a verst from the house, Levin saw Grisha and Tanya running toward him. "Uncle Kostya, Mama is coming, and Grandpapa, and Sergius Ivanich, and someone else," they cried, clambering into the trap. "Who else?" "An awfully dreadful man, and he goes like that with his hands," said Tanya, standing up in the trap and mimicking Katavsov. "Young or old?" asked Levin with a laugh, as Tanya's gestures reminded him of someone. "Oh, if only it's not someone disagreeable," he thought. As soon as he had turned the corner of the road and saw those who were approaching, he at once recognized Katavsov in a straw hat, waving his arms just as Tanya had represented. Katavsov was very fond of talking about philosophy, having a conception of it, which he had acquired from naturalists who had never studied it, and in Moscow, Levin had latterly had many disputes with him. Excuse me. One of those disputes, in which Katavsov evidently thought he had been the victor, was the first thing Levin remembered when he recognized him. "But I will not now, on any account, dispute or express my opinions lightly," he thought. After alighting from the trap and welcoming his brother and Katavsov, Levin asked where Kitty was. "She has taken Mitya to Kolok, which is a wood not far from the house. She wanted to let him sleep there. It's so hot in the house," said Dolly. Levin always advised his wife not to take the child into the wood, considering it dangerous, and this news was disagreeable to him. "She wanders about with him from place to place," said the old prince with a smile. "I advised her to try taking him to the ice cellar. She meant to come to the apiary. She thought you were there." "We are going there," said Dolly. "Well, and what are you doing?" asked Koznishev, lagging behind with his brother. "Oh, nothing particular. Busy with the estate as usual," answered Levin. "Have you come for a good stay? We expected you long ago." "For about a fortnight. I had a lot to do in Moscow." At these words, the brothers' eyes met, and Levin, in spite of the desire he always felt, and now more than ever, for friendly and especially for simple relations with his brother, felt ill at ease while looking at him. He dropped his own eyes, not knowing what to say. Mentally reviewing the subjects that might interest Koznishev and divert him from the Serbian war and the Slavonic question at which he had hinted when mentioning his work in Moscow, Levin asked about Koznishev's book. "Have any reviews of your book appeared?" he asked. Koznishev smiled at the obvious intent of the question. "No one concerns himself with it, and I at least of all, he replied. "Look there, Darya Alexandrovna, it's going to rain," he added, pointing with his umbrella to some white clouds that had appeared above the aspen trees. And those words were enough to re-establish between the brothers the not exactly hostile but cold relations which Levin so wished to avoid. Levin joined Katavsov. "How right you were to come," he said. "I have long been meaning to. Now we'll have some talks, and we'll see. Have you read Spencer?" "No, I have not finished him," replied Levin. "However, I don't need him now." "How's that? It's interesting. Why not?" "Well, I have finally convinced myself that I shan't find solutions of the questions I am concerned about in him or in people of his kind. Now." But he was suddenly struck by the calm and cheerful expression of Katavsov's face, and felt so sorry to lose the spiritual condition which he was evidently spoiling by his conversation, that recollecting his resolution, he ceased speaking. "However, we'll have a talk later on," he said. "If we are going to the apiary, it's this way, along this path," he added, addressing the whole party. When by the narrow footpath they had reached the unmown glade, covered on one side by a thick growth of bright John and Mary's, With tall spreading bushes of dark green sneezewort between them, Levin asked his guests to sit down in the deep cool shade of the young aspens upon a bench and some tree stumps specially arranged for visitors to the apiary who might be afraid of bees, while he went to the hut to fetch bread, cucumbers, and fresh honey for the grown-up people as well as for the children. Trying to make a few brusque movements as possible and listening to the bees that flew past him more and more often, he went along the path to the hut. At the very entrance, a bee became entangled in his beard and began buzzing, but he carefully liberated it. He went into the shady lobby and from a peg in the wall, took down his veil, put it on, and with his hands deep in his pockets, entered the fenced-in apiary where, standing in the regular rows and tied with bast to stakes in the middle of a space where the grass had been mown, stood the old beehives, hollowed out stumps of trees placed upright, says the footnote. Everyone familiar to him and each with a history of its own, while along the wattle fences stood the new hives with the swarms hived that year. In front of the hives, flickering before his eyes and circling and fluttering over the same spot, played bees and drones, and between them flew the working bees always to or from the wood with the blossoming lime trees, fetching and bringing back their loads. In his ears rang incessantly a variety of sounds, now of a busy working bee flying swiftly past, now of a buzzing idle drone, then of the excited bee sentinels guarding their treasure from a foe and preparing to sting. On the other side of the fence, an old man was making a hoop and did not notice Levin, who stopped in the middle of the apiary without calling him. He was glad of this opportunity to be alone and recover from reality, which had already so lowered his spiritual condition. He remembered that he had already got angry with Ivan, treated his brother coldly, and spoken heedlessly to Katavasov. Can it possibly have been but a momentary mood that will pass without leaving a trace, he wondered. But at that instant, returning into that mood, he felt with joy that something new and important had occurred within him. Reality had temporarily veiled the spiritual tranquility he had found, but it remained within him. Just as the bees now circling round him, threatening him and distracting his attention, deprived him of complete physical calm and forced him to shrink to avoid them, so the cares that had beset him from the moment he got into the trap had deprived him of spiritual freedom, but that continued only so long as they surrounded him. And as in spite of the bees, his physical powers remained intact, so his newly realized spiritual powers were intact also. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down. We're very close to the end. Couple of chapters to go. Thank you very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.